Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening. So let's all take the Zazen posture. And in particular, consider your hands, the way your hands are held together. The palms of the hands are facing upward. The left hand rests on top of the right hand. So, somewhere in the early days of Buddhism, somebody determined that the left hand represents enlightenment or our spiritual faculties. And the right hand, which is underneath, represents delusion or illusion. So, enlightenment and delusion exist together. Enlightenment covers delusion. The thumbs together, barely touching. There's no separation. No separation between the thumbs. And this, what they call a mudra, when we hold it like this, it signifies no separation between enlightenment and delusion, and no separation between left and right, no separation between this self and our big mind. And this mudra is intended to help us have deep concentration and find tranquility and inner peace. It also provides a feeling of warmth. Try it. See if this mudra does not give you a feeling of warmth. This is the traditional way we hold our hands. This is our traditional practice that came to us from China and Japan. Today, we're in a different situation. Today, we have a new technology. Many new technologies. One of these new technologies is what we call wearable devices, where you can have something on your wrist or something on your thumb. And this morning, somebody was explaining that they now have them. You can get a ring. You can have a ring on your finger that will detect your stress levels, if agitation. Your exercise levels, your heartbeat, your fitness, how you're recovering, how well you sleep. This wearable device can determine everything about your physical condition. It can monitor your physical system as well as your nervous system, and can lead to improved health. That's technology. Last week, somebody showed me a very new wearable device. It's to be used in Zazen. Held in your palm, with your thumbs pressing on two buttons. Not like this, but this new technology says, put your thumbs on these buttons. The point of this device is, with your thumbs on the button, the device will detect when you are in meditation and will provide a reward. The whole system is very complicated, so I won't explain all of it, except that when this device detects that you're doing meditation, there's a payoff. There's a payoff. And the reward may be valuable, you know? Payoff may be a good thing. But this device gets in the way of our practice, this piece of technology. And what can happen is, of course, if you get used to it and you like the reward, you fall in love with it, you become to depend on this external device in the middle of your practice. And of course, when we start to depend on an external device rather than pay attention to ourself, we will lose our awareness and we will lose this sensitivity of ourself. If I'm pressing down on these buttons with my thumbs, I don't know if I'm holding my thumbs correctly. Just another way that people are finding uses for technology. We are not machines. People are not machines. And you are not a machine. We are feeling beings. We are not mechanical beings. This entity is more than logical and more than clever. And our practice is about discovering and expressing the feeling side of our nature. The side of our nature that is caring, that is generous, that has determination, that has no ego, that doesn't strive. The side of our nature that is easily satisfied with whatever life brings. That's who we are. We're not a machine. So the story about the Buddha is very well known. Born into a royal family and lived the life of a prince with many wonderful attributes. A future well planned. He's going to be the king and had a lovely family. When he was in his mid-20s or so, he went out of the palace the first time. And he went into the local villages and he saw ordinary people. He saw how people suffered. He saw people who were sick. He saw people who were very poor. He saw old people and many, many people having a very hard life in the villages, you know, around the castle. And he was touched by their suffering, touched very deeply by their suffering. He was touched so much that he left his royal life. He left the castle. He put that comfortable life behind and went out to be in the world. And as we know, the Buddha did not leave his easy life, his easy royal life, just to have some kind of comfortable seclusion in the forest. Mm. he left the palace to be with ordinary people and their difficulties because he was touched by their suffering. And he felt some responsibility. He wanted to find some way to help them with their lives. He wanted to help them with their lives, not just to make them feel good or to make them feel comfortable. He wanted to help them with the most profound and difficult of all human problems. And that is the knowledge that we are going to die. That knowledge causes great suffering for people, and there's no way to stop it, which is part of the suffering. There is no way to stop it. We are going to die. It is inevitable. And people suffer from it greatly. There's no way to stop it. So it looks like, well, there's no way to help people with that. There is no stopping death. Can't help people with that. But the Buddha took up this impossible problem anyhow. And he didn't give up. I'm going to help people overcome their fear of death. Wow. This man must have had a very extraordinary spirit to take on that kind of problem. So much of what Buddha spoke about in his life, in his life of preaching to people, life of passing on the practice and passing on the teachings, he talked a lot about the problem of birth and death, because he knew it was a big problem for people, serious problem for people. And he felt that by exploring it with everybody, by talking about it, it might lead to the understanding of life and death. And facing that problem would build firm character in people. And as we know, when our mind is troubled by this problem or constrained by this problem, we won't be able to find composure in our life if we are concerned about our death and the inevitability of our dying. There's no composure in life. This is the problem that the Buddha took up. So what he had in mind for our practice is to see our life completely, to see our life beyond life and death, the distinctions between life and death. Our practice is to see and confront all of life's problems with determination. His view was that confronting our difficulties, including our death, with determination was how we gain spiritual understanding and gain mastery over life and death. So the Buddha advised his disciples to be very caring in their life. He said to them, when you travel, you should be quiet, you should trust people, and treat people as your friends wherever you go. If you do this, people will trust you. And you can talk to them about the problem of life and death. So, as you know, in Buddhism has a set of precepts, much like Judaism, Christianity. The Buddha's precepts are intended to advise people how to live their life without conflict and in accord with the truth of things, as well as how to avoid suffering. The precepts are kind of a recipe for avoiding suffering. And the precepts include don't kill, no stealing, no lying, no intoxication, no slandering others, no praising yourself or blaming others, no making a large collection of possessions, don't be angry, don't dishonor people, and always respect the three treasures. So these are the 10 precepts. And when thinking about those precepts one day, some time ago, I was surprised to recognize that there was one that was not included. Indifference. Indifference, I thought, should be one of the precepts. For our life to be vital, to be able to express our true self completely, we cannot be indifferent. So if we were to include an 11th precept, it would say something like, a disciple of the Buddha is not indifferent to people, places, or things. So our way that flows out of our practice is to care about suffering, to care about the world we live in and the people who are in the world we live in, and to care about the authenticity of our life. Caring is the foundation of our practice, our spiritual practice. And not to care, when we don't care about our life, it means we are indifferent. And this is not a satisfying way to live. Sometimes people feel that their life isn't going very well, that they're troubled by something, and they don't know what it is. Oftentimes, they don't recognize that they're not taking their life seriously, that they are indifferent. If we are interested only in Zen practice for what it can provide us personally, we are indifferent. And indifference leads to disengagement. Indifference means caring means indifference leads to disengagement. disengagement leads to ignorance, and ignorance leads to fear. When we get caught in that kind of cycle of indifference, then our life is no more than going through the motions. And that is another form of suffering. With or through our practice, indifference can turn into passion. And an engaged life. We can turn our indifference into an engaged life. When we are not indifferent, we can hear the bird's song, and we can feel gratitude, and we can express gratitude. And when we hear the bird's song, we can silently say thank you. And we will know that the bird is also thanking us. We don't need much more than that in our life. I think it's a very nice feeling to practice here. It's a very nice space. It's comfortable. It's safe. We are supported by each other. You are with friends. It's nice to practice here. But we have to leave here and go there, go out there. And daily life is not always safe and friendly, as we know. It's uncertain, it's competitive, it's speedy, it's stressful. But it's where we are. It's where we have to practice, in the midst of all that. So how do we practice in the frantic and messy world? Where we can't but feel to be distracted, and it's hard to find a calm place. On the other hand, out there are opportunities everywhere for practice. My wife and daughter and I had to go from here on Friday. My grandson was... There was a football game. His high school was at a football game, so we had to go up in East Bay. But we didn't leave on time. You know what the traffic is like if you don't target your journey just right. It's very stressful and takes a long time. So traffic, as we know, is very, very difficult around here. So most people don't like red lights, but I don't mind. Actually, I have some appreciation for what they do. When I am stopped at a red light or stopped in a line that's stopped at a red light, I know that I am helping to make possible for the people with the green light to go from left to right and to go from right to left. And when I have the green light and others have the red, I feel they are helping me to go north and south. When stopped at a red light, we have a chance to be calm. We have a chance to set aside our impatience and a chance to observe our immediate world right in front of us and all around us. When I'm stopped at a red light, I like to observe the people who are walking, crossing the street. How are they doing it? Some with attention and some without attention. It's interesting to see how people walk around. I like to observe the people who are driving and how they're doing it. I like to observe the pets they have in their car. You know, isn't it fun to see somebody's dog with his head out the window enjoying the breeze? That's great fun to watch. Sometimes there's an overhead wire, and I like seeing the birds sitting on the wire in a big flock. And without any warning, they all take off all at once. And maybe they just come back. It's great to watch that. I like to observe the sky when it's clear and enjoy its brightness. And I like to observe the mountains and when the clouds cover the mountains, and also feel the rain. All during the red light stop. When we are stopped at a red light, we don't have to disengage from life and feel that this red light is like a blockade. It's preventing me from getting on with my life. We can sit at a red light and feel the flowing nature of life. And we can feel the harmony we create for each other by stopping and waiting for each other. And we can say to ourselves, we know how to do this. We know how to create a community. So, a red light can remind us that we don't have to win. We don't have to win the traffic battle. We don't have to compete all the time. We don't have to compete as we all move towards our own personal destinations. We know we can be in harmony. For the benefit of each other. And we know we can be in harmony in all of our daily activities. Not just in traffic. When we have that understanding that it is possible to be in complete harmony all the time, we have a sense of our endless community. Our endless community with each other and with all creatures. Without separation. Our mudra reminds us of that also. No separation. And we can feel that in the activities of our daily life. Stopping at a red light is just one of those activities. And of course, it helps if we don't let ourselves get distracted by some device. Be fully engaged in what we're doing.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.